been murdered. Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. And the bird said nevermore.
You're listening to The Call Podcast with Brandon and Josh.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new edition of The Call. It is a Baltimore Ravens podcast where we talk anything and everything Baltimore Ravens football. Thank you for listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Baltimore Sports Report Network, Player.fm, Overcast, Google Play Music, and Satchel. Well, as you can tell, since there was no echo on that Overcast tag right there, that it's just me for this episode. It is the off season. We've got the draft coming up. There's just a lot of like business moves going on, so there's not too much for Josh and I to talk about. And we came up to an anniversary the end of March. And it was the anniversary of when the Baltimore Colts left town in the middle of the night in Mayflower trucks. A little before my time. I was born in 85, so I didn't know what it was like. I've only seen pictures. You know, there's that famous picture of the Mayflower truck going past the Baltimore Colts sign. It's snowing out. It's dark out. And a friend of mine at work, he was actually a part of the local media at the time when this all happened. He was on air in a newsroom for the radio as the news broke that the Baltimore Colts were leaving town. So I thought it would be kind of a cool idea to talk to him and hear about what it was like that day. What was the tone in the office like? Because they're sharing this news that changed everything. I mean, how much the city love the Colts and everything that went down with the Colts. I mean, think about how Baltimore and the Ravens are kind of ingrained with each other. I mean, that's what it was back in the day as well. So I talked to my friend Jim about it, what it was like to be there, what it was like to tell people, and took a couple microphones, and we recorded our conversation about it. So I wanted to share that conversation with you guys and let you hear what it was like. Maybe some of you out there are just big Ravens fans. You don't know the history of football in Baltimore. I know we have a lot of international listeners. So I thought it'd kind of be, what would it be like if the football team you loved, the football team that represented your city, your town, yourself, what if in the middle of the night they just were gone out of nowhere? So we had a good conversation. We're going to hear that in a little bit. He's going to tell us all about what it was like, because it was one thing to be a fan and have it gone, but to be a part of the media and the one reporting, telling everybody this bad news was something else. So here's my conversation with Jim Bigwood. He tells us all about the day that the Colts left Baltimore. So did you grow up in Baltimore, around Baltimore your whole life?
I did. Yeah? I did. I grew up in southeast Baltimore County, and I was a Colts fan from the time I was born, actually.
So, I mean, the Colts were a little bit before my time, but was there Colts fever, kind of like there is Ravens fever every season? I mean, did they mean as much to Baltimore as the Ravens do now?
I actually think they meant more.
Really?
It was an amazing thing. My father told me that when they first came in the late 40s, when they were in the All-America Football Conference, he said you could get season tickets, you know, but by the time I was a small child, you had no shot at season tickets.
Right.
As a matter of fact, people used to fight over season tickets. You know, if somebody had season tickets and they passed away, their relatives would fight over who got the tickets.
Yeah, to leave it in a will or something.
Yeah, pretty much. I'll tell you how intense it was. The first game I ever saw was in September of 68. I believe it was the Colts versus the 49ers. And the only reason I got to that game was because someone we knew had two tickets,
mm-hmm.
and they were like in almost the top row of the temporary stands in the open end of the horseshoe, as where we saw. And I watched Johnny Unitas battle it out with I can't remember the guy's name who was a quarterback of the 49ers at that time. John Brody, that's it.
There you go. Okay.
And so the place was full. That was the first game I could ever get into. So I decided that when I got old enough, I would join the Baltimore Colts marching band just so I could see games. And I did, 1972. I was in the band for 2 years. And it was amazing. You know, the place was a sellout every game.
And I mean, there's the ESPN 30 for 30 about the band that wouldn't die. I mean, it seems as if it was such a huge blow to the city.
Oh, it was.
And to the fans when they left. But I wanted you on the show because you kind of had a unique experience the day that the Colts left, because you were actually involved in the media and were a part of the team reporting it.
I did. I worked for WBAL from the late 70s through the early 90s, so I was there at the time that the Colts left. But just to let you know, to back it up a little bit before we kind of get into that part,
yeah,
the Colts mania was amazing. I mean, the movie that depicted – what was the name of the movie where they had the little trivia contest to see if the guy's wife was good enough to marry him.
Oh,
it was Colts. Shoot.
I don't remember.
Can't remember the name of it. It was like, it wasn't Tin Man, but it was before Diner. That was it. Diner.
Okay.
And I was actually working at the station when they were shooting Diner in and around Baltimore, and they used some of our control rooms for that show.
Oh, okay.
Or that movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when I joined the Colts band, Carol Rosenblum had just he had just swapped the Rams with Robert Irsay.
Mm-hmm.
He had engineered that thing so Irsay was by the Rams, they would swap, and Irsay would end up with the Colts. And the first thing we noticed that is that all people in the Colts band, it was completely volunteer at that time.
Right.
But for your services, you were given two free season tickets. And at that time, a season ticket, a single game ticket cost about $8.80.
God, that sounds nice.
It was. So you'd get two of those. And the idea was a lot of people in the Colts band at that time, you were either, you know, old and working, or you were like a kid in mm-hmm. like high school, like I was. I was a high school kid. So you'd get two free tickets so your parents could come to the game. You know, maybe they'd give you a lift to the game. You'd go and do the thing. They'd go watch it.
Right.
And as soon as Irsay took over the team, that changed. You got one free season ticket and the opportunity to buy the other.
Okay, so he came in and immediately.
It was an immediate difference.
Yeah.
It was completely felt different, everything. And so he would do stuff along the way. I mean, there was all those things where he would take the team and play a game in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
or he'd play a game in Tampa, or, you know, they would go around and do different things with the team. And people were starting to get restless about it.
Yeah.
You know, and excitement was waning a little bit. And then, you know, he brought Joe Thomas in as general manager, and he completely muffed or fumbled the Johnny Unitas transition,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was just awful. And then, of course, Unitas goes off and plays a year in San Diego.
How does that transition compare to what we're seeing today with the transition from Joe Flacco to Lamar Jackson? I mean, new GM wants to make a name
right.
for himself.
Well, here's the difference. The GM of the Ravens has been with the Ravens since they came to Baltimore
right.
in 96. Yeah. So he is part of the fabric of the team. Joe Thomas came in totally from the outside.
Gotcha.
Brought in a totally outside coach, Frank Kush, who nobody really liked. And so they were starting to alienate the fan base. Mm. I don't feel that same alienation. And God bless Joe Flacco. I love him for winning us a Super Bowl and Super Bowl 47.
Yeah.
But he didn't have the kind of idolatry that Johnny Unitas did.
Right.
Who won the 58 championship, the 59 championship, you know. Yes, we lost Super Bowl III, but he wasn't playing for most of it. When he came in, we scored a touchdown, and I thought we were going to win that one.
Right.
But, you know, and it, we went on to win Super Bowl V. But he was God in this town. I mean, when I was a kid, the Crown Central Petroleum Company had all these Crown stations around town, gas stations, and there was two faces you saw on advertising posters in every Crown gas station. One was Johnny Unitas, and the other was Brooks Robinson.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And those guys were just like gods, you know, baseball and football gods to this entire town. And so there was a kind of feeling about them that was totally different than you get from today's players. I mean, people... What was it that Seinfeld said? You don't root for the people so much as you root for the laundry. You know?
Right. Yeah.
And it's almost kind of gotten like that. So I don't get that same feeling with the new turnover because mm-hmm. I feel like Eric DaCosta has been a Raven since the Ravens were Ravens.
Right. And he had opportunities to go other places and decided to stay.
Which was, you know, different in this day and time. And, you know, bringing Lamar in, and they did the transition. And, you know, I think a lot of people who really even like Joe Flacco don't think that he was the answer going forward for
right.
this team.
Sure.
And I'm curious to see how it works out for him in Denver. But
he's already got a Ford dealership, so he already got himself a truck.
That. I saw that online. So, anyway, so there was a lot of unease and ill feelings toward Irsay and the people that he was bringing in to run the show
mm-hmm.
prior to any of the stuff happening. And then the fact that I don't know if you've ever seen the video of him coming to getting off a plane at BWI at the time. I don't know if it's still called Friendship Airport at that point. I don't remember when they changed the name.
Yeah.
But, you know, Don Schaefer was there, and then he came in and did that.
He got kind of a little ambushed.
Drunken press conference.
I remember seeing that, yeah.
When he was talking about Don Schaefer as his friend and all that kind of stuff. And this was kind of surreal to us at the time when we had such stable ownership up mm-hmm. until this point. And I was talking to someone I know who was reflecting on all that time, and he's now harboring ill feelings towards Rosenblum for, you know, not keeping the Colts, wanting to have the Los Angeles Rams and
right.
engineering that whole deal. He said we wouldn't be in the problems that we were in if he had taken care of it. And as an owner, he would take care of his players. I mean, you know, he would help set people up in business afterwards, and the players lived in the community and worked in the community. I mean, you know, God bless Joe Flacco, but he didn't live here year-round like the players did
right.
at the time. I mean, the neighborhood that I lived in Towson, you know, there were Colts players that were coaching the Pee Wee football team.
Right.
You know, how fair is that to other coaches? But, I mean,
right, yeah.
You know. If you got somebody like Ordell Bracy coaching your Pee Wee football team, you have a built-in advantage, I think.
Yeah.
But
how was BAL radio? Because you were on the radio side, right?
I was on the radio side.
How were they covering up until the day that they left? You were saying how the Irsay, you know, Schaefer would talk to him at the airport, or he was probably drunk at the time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff where they were alienating the fans.
They were.
Were you getting a lot of feedback on the radio from fans that they
yeah.
felt that way?
And yes, they were very unhappy.
Yeah.
People just hated Robert Irsay and before he left, to the fact that, you know, I worked on the morning show with two really talented announcers, Bob Jones and Jim West.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob had done pregame stuff with Don Shula when he was the coach of the Colts back in the day. And Jim West was our sports guy, and he had transitioned into being the one of the morning show hosts. And Jim, you know, was also, people may not remember this, he was the actual stadium announcer during the last bit of the Colts being in Baltimore at Memorial Stadium.
Yeah.
He does what Bruce Cunningham now does at M&T Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they gave him two tickets and a parking pass. And the two tickets that he got were on the 50-yard line in the like midway up the upper deck. It was like the primo seats where all, as we used to say, the BPs would sit, or the beautiful people. You know? And so he would often, because I was, you know, worked with him every day, he'd say, yeah, you want my tickets to the game? You know, there were certain games where his family wanted to go,
or sure,
people from out of town. But, you know, and I would go. And so I was literally at the last game in Memorial Stadium.
Oh, wow.
And I still have the ticket stubs, as a matter of fact,
cool,
in my little Colts glass that I got for buying a tank of gas at one of the gas station promotions at the time.
I think I've seen those at, like, yard sales and
yes,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I still have one of those, and I stuck my little tickets in there, and that's where they are. But I remember being in the stadium and looking around, and the stadium was not full.
Yeah.
It was maybe half to two-thirds full. There were a lot of empty seats.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, boy, this is not good.
Yeah.
Didn't feel good. People were almost resigned to the fact that they thought that Irsay was going to move the team.
Right.
We just didn't know where or when. And when the game ended, I remember looking at the scoreboard, you know, the old quote-unquote half a scoreboard that they had in Memorial Stadium.
Right.
And when they put it up, they put up the season, the 1984 schedule, who we were going to play. And I remember looking to my colleague that was sitting next to me, my friend, and I said, geez, I wonder where they're going to be playing those games. You know, because we all had this, we just felt like something was going to happen.
Yeah.
We just didn't know where or when.
It kind of seems like in today's world with, you know, social media and the
right,
web and everything, to pull off what they did back then would be almost impossible because of all the different contracts and everything going on. So,
right.
I mean, it was definitely a different time and place, but you're saying that there was still a feeling in the air that something was happening.
He was shopping that team around. We didn't know if they were going to Phoenix. We didn't know if they were going to Tampa. We didn't know where they were going. And there were people that thought, well, I'll believe it when I see it. And
right,
then there were other people who were thinking, you know, the problem was he wanted a brand new stadium, and they couldn't get that through. They could not get that through the legislature.
Right. I remember the MPT put out a Schaefer documentary a couple
right,
years ago, and that was covered in that.
That was covered in that. And it was like Memorial Stadium was, you know, for all the nostalgia that people have about Memorial Stadium, it wasn't the greatest place to watch
sure,
a game.
Yeah.
And it was one of those hybrid stadiums that was built for baseball and football.
Right, that we still see in like in Oakland.
Right.
Yeah.
And anytime you have something that's going to do something for this sport and this sport, it not tailored to either sport, it wasn't great.
Yeah.
So, you know, did I love Memorial Stadium? Absolutely. The first game I ever saw in Memorial Stadium, I went to a baseball game and my uncle took me to with my father. And it was, I believe, June 7th, 1962, and Mickey Mantle broke his ankle in the outfield because
ooh,
at that time the outfield had a chain link fence and was padded on the top and padded down the sides. He went out there, got his spikes caught, broke his ankle.
Ooh.
And so he came out of the game. Nobody knew about that. Then they made an announcement later on in the game that he was out because he had broken his ankle, and the fans cheered in the stands, believe it or not, because the Yankees were so hated
right,
at that time. So, if you see people doing untoward things in the stands now, it has some history.
Sure, yeah.
And I remember talking to Jim West, who was in the press booth at the time, you know, much later when I was working with him. He said, we were all so embarrassed when that happened because all the New York media is around there looking at us because, you know, here are people cheering somebody getting hurt.
Yeah.
And that was awful.
It's a very Philly thing to do.
Yes. Not Baltimore, yeah. Right. So, you know, I'd been to all kinds of games. And I remember once, you know, you left that stadium and then you would come back to it for something, you'd forget how small and ill-prepared it was for football or baseball or anything else. Because certainly Camden Yards, much, much better place to watch a game, and M&T Bank Stadium too.
Yeah, and Camden Yards became a staple of how to build a baseball stadium.
How to build a baseball stadium. If you want to know how not to build a baseball stadium, you should go take a look at Old Memorial Stadium.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you know, there was this feeling of dread, like something was going to happen, and it finally did. So you're probably leading up to that day. What was it, March 29th?
Yeah.
1983.
Right, you said it was 35 years ago this year.
Yes, it was.
And but you probably were going into work that day thinking that you guys were going to be covering the snowstorm, the late snowstorm in Baltimore. You had no idea going into work that day it was going to be history.
Absolutely not. It was just another day of work. I worked the shift 4 a.m. to noon, so I was usually half numb, you know, when you get up every day at 2:30 in the morning and slog your way to work. And
right.
I was there, and we were doing our normal thing, trying to come up with ideas and things. And we're in the middle of the show, and our news anchor, who I believe at the time was a guy named Tom Clendenning, came running in and said, got Mark Miller on the phone, who was one of our reporters.
Yeah.
And he says, we got to put him on right now.
So was this on air, or were you guys like at a commercial? So in the middle of the show, somebody comes into the studio and
– essentially, yeah. He said, we got to put him on the air.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. So we get him on the phone. I pot it up on the console. And he said, I'm looking out my bedroom window. I live at Morningside Heights, off of Owings Mills Boulevard. And I'm looking down. My bedroom window overlooks the Colts complex, and there's all of these Mayflower moving vans in there. And it looks like they're emptying out the Colts complex. And at this point, nobody knew they were going to Indianapolis,
right,
where they were coming from. People were assuming that they were local Mayflower vans. Of course, they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
They were vans from Indianapolis. And I later learned from reading about it that the Colts had gone to this college in Indianapolis and went to a frat house. And talked to a bunch of the guys in the frat house and said, hey, you want to make some money?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They hired frat boys for like $50 or $100 to go with these moving vans and be the moving guys to just take all the stuff out and put it in. Nobody knew that.
So, again, these guys are just like, oh, cool, I'll make a couple bucks. And, again, a part of history.
A part of history. They, they had no idea what they were doing. Didn't tell them. And I heard that those vans had, stayed just outside the border of Maryland and just before midnight. And then at midnight, they rolled in and rolled into the complex.
Right. And when they left, wasn't it like a police escort to get them out of the state, something like that?
Yeah, kind of. I don't remember the details on that, but I think they kind of did. And, there's a famous picture you can see of the photo of the truck and the snow's coming down.
Yeah,
and
it's Baltimore Colts
sign,
right.
And there's a guy leaning up against that sign. That guy, have you ever seen the super fan at Raven Stadium that dresses up in the Joker hat and has all the beads on?
Yeah.
And does all the stuff? That was that guy.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
He had grown up with the Colts. And he had somehow found out what was happening. He just went there and stood there and watched. He's literally in that picture.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, wow.
So BAL had three stations within the building.
Uh-huh.
We had WBAL AM, and literally 6 feet across the hall was 98 Rock.
Yeah.
And then down on the second, we were up on the third floor, down on the second floor was BAL TV. And our sports anchor on BAL TV at the time was Vince Bagley, the dean of Baltimore sports, as you could say. And Vince went out to the complex because he had a desk in the Colts complex with personal items in it.
Okay.
His personal items. They would not let him in the building to get his stuff out.
Really? Wow.
They barred him from that. He was not happy.
So, unless you were there people that still worked for the Colts that were allowed in, No, it was just the movers and...
Nobody that worked for the Colts, you know, locally, knew this was happening. They were secretaries showing up to go to work that were barred from the building, and they were crying.
I'm sure. Yeah, this is life-changing.
Secretary, yeah, this is life-changing. They just lost their job.
Yeah.
You know, none of the local people knew this was stuff was happening. It was just awful. It was a sad, weird day. It felt weird.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard from people that I'm relatives with, friends, dads, stuff like that, that
right.
This day, a lot of the times they say was the first time they saw their dad cry.
There you go.
It was the first time that they saw that. It was this city. It was like a gut punch to Baltimore that a part of them kind of died that day.
Absolutely.
And... I mean, I'm trying to imagine that now because, I mean, I knew Baltimore without football for a couple years of my life, but right. For the majority of it, the Ravens have always been there. But to be so invested in it and to just have that taken away, I mean, even if you are angry at the team or you're unhappy with their play, I mean, that's still a part of it. It's still a part of your life, and that's just gone. And the way they left...
Right.
I mean, to do it at night, to do it without telling anyone, trying to get out of Dodge. What was your friend the first person to see what was going on, or was news kind of spreading at that point?
I think news was spreading and trickling out at that point. But he called us up because he'd gotten up to go to work and looked out his bedroom window and saw what was going on.
Yeah.
And then there were two people, I think, that reported on that with phone calls. One was Brenda Carl.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was on CBM at the time, and Mark Miller was on BAL. And I don't know who got on the air first, but they were kind of concurrent,
right.
Describing essentially the same
but,
stuff.
But again, he's in his bedroom window just right. Kind of saying what he's seeing. There's still no official word from the team or anything like that saying, hey, see you later, we're out of here.
There's none of that. And as a matter of fact, what he did was he got dressed and he just put his press pass on and went right across the street.
Right.
To start finding out and reporting for us. You know, it was, you know, we were almost having like a funeral on the air for the Colts that morning. It was sad. People were calling in, reminiscing, and, you know, the Colts were a little bit different to me than the Ravens because mm-hmm. they were the fabric of the community. The
right.
players were the fabric.
Right.
Because the players lived here. They didn't make enormous salaries. A lot of them in the early days had second jobs. they play football for $7,000 or $8,000, and then they'd have to go work at the point.
Right.
You know, doing something or have a business, you know. Jim Parker had his liquor store, or, you know, Ordell Bracy had the Flaming Pit.
Right.
You know, the stuff that guys, Andy Nelson made barbecue. You know?
He still does on York Road.
Still does. But, you know, these guys had second jobs because you couldn't live on your football salary. It wasn't enough money, and you only got paid on game day. It wasn't like they would spread it out.
Right.
So, you know, heck, Johnny Unitas worked down at the point in the early days. So, it was these were guys you could watch on Sunday and see on TV, but you might see them in your local, you know, watering hole, and they talk to you and be friends with you. Artie Donovan, I mean, in my generation, whose Cub Scout pack didn't have their blue and gold banquet at the Valley Inn?
Right.
You know, and there's Artie Donovan there. You know, it's they were just such – integrated into the community the way that players today aren't necessarily, because
right.
they make a lot of money and they don't have to live here. Some of them do, but
sure.
you don't have to. You know, a lot of times they prefer to live somewhere else. I know, I think Terrell Suggs always kept his main home in Arizona.
Yeah, and that's why we see him in the Arizona Red
yes.
now.
Swapped one bird for another on
right.
the helmet. But, you know, that's not to say that he didn't like Baltimore, but
sure.
it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, I mean, as much as everybody loves Ray Lewis and he's a symbol for the city,
right.
he's not here year-round. He goes back to home to Miami. That's where he lives now. He has a couple businesses here, so he's still giving back to the community.
Right.
But it's not the way it was back then. But
yeah.
did you have any players come on the radio maybe that day or a couple weeks later to say, like, how shocked they were?
Yeah. Jim had a lot of contacts with, you know, all the old Colts, Ordell Bracy and, you know, Tom Matty and Artie Donovan and stuff. I don't remember us having Unitas on, but we had a lot of those guys. And they were all talking about what a shame it was. And, you know, you feel for those players. Their whole thing, their legacy got ripped away. How do you – if you had NFL records,
mm-hmm.
and you're in the Hall of Fame, how would you like it if it lists you as being an Indianapolis Colt?
I mean, that's what they have for Johnny U right now.
And that's
yeah.
all of them.
Yeah.
You know, they were Hall of Famers. You know, and they – you know, most of them never even stepped foot in the state of Indiana, much less played for the Indianapolis Colts.
Right.
So – you know, I think that's wrong. Baseball at least does it right. If you're a Brooklyn Dodger, you're listed as a Brooklyn Dodger, not a Los Angeles Dodger.
Right.
So I do have a problem with that. But you were talking about how they were able to pull this off. Remember, there was no social media.
Right.
There was a lot of outcry among the press in different places, but it died down pretty fast because there wasn't this tremendous vehicle of social media where people could just, you know, put up a stink. When the Browns decided to move to Baltimore to become the Ravens,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot more social media outlet, which is why I always felt that the NFL gave Cleveland another team.
Right.
Because, they needed to put a good spin on what was happening.
Right.
Whereas when we lost our team, we lost our team. And it was like, hey, you lost your team.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Sorry. Yeah. You know. Well, we raised a lot of money to build a stadium. You know, all right, go ahead and you build a museum with it or something. So.
What was Donald Schaefer's response to losing this team?
Oh,
crushed. There's clips of it that you can see on YouTube and, again, the Schaefer documentary that MPT produced. But he was fighting hard to keep this team here and then – for them to leave in the middle of the night again.
Right.
I mean, as a politician, he was probably hurt, but personally, because he also was a Baltimore guy,
right.
he was hurt as well.
He was crushed. He was crushed. I've never seen that man look that down in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before the vans rolled up, they were working hard down in Annapolis to try to get some sort of eminent domain thing through so they could condemn the team and that they, you know, they couldn't leave.
Right.
And they were not able to do that. So all you folks that love M&T Bank Stadium and all you folks that love Camden Yards, you can thank the Baltimore Colts for that.
That's true. I didn't think about
that.
You can
100% thank the Baltimore Colts for that, because when the Colts left, Orioles attendance skyrocketed.
Right.
Remember, the Orioles were not a big draw. They were the best team in baseball for 20 or 25 years. We had the All-Star game here in the early 60s. I think it was 62 or 63. I can't remember exactly, but it was around that time. And about the early 70s, when they were really, really good, it was our turn to host the All-Star game again, and the club turned them down.
Wow,
repeatedly,
really?
Because they were afraid – that we wouldn't be able to sell out the stadium.
Oh, that's wild.
And we would look bad on national television. You know, so if you wanted a World Series ticket in 1970, you could get one.
That's
crazy. I'm not to say that it wasn't kind of full, but
yeah.
It wasn't like you can't get a ticket at all.
Right.
So what happened after the Colts left? Oh, suddenly people were like paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
That anything would happen to the Orioles. So, you know, and now the Orioles were owned by Edward Bennett Williams, who was from Washington. Washington didn't have a baseball team.
Right.
So people around here were petrified that he would pick that team up and move it to Washington, and we'd
okay.
have no baseball team, no football team. So they started, I'm telling you, it was the best thing for ticket sales in the Orioles to have the Colts leave. The other thing was, now the Orioles could make a little move, you know, subtle innuendos that, you know, we really do need a new stadium.
Right.
So Schaefer, by that time, was able to push through the stadium bill that said, you know, and you remember they went on this 21 game losing streak at the mm-hmm. beginning of the 88 season. And when they finally came back home, that's when they announced that they had this deal in place and there would be a new stadium in a couple of years, which ended up being Camden Yards. You know, we still had that money in place for the other stadium too. That
right.
was part of that package because we wanted football, which is was the bargaining chip to get the Browns to come here. Now, as a person who had had their hometown team ripped from them and feeling totally powerless, everybody in the city felt powerless. There's nothing we could do to keep the Colts. It just
right.
happened.
Yeah.
You know.
But
to watch what happened to them, there was a lot of people like me that was like, oh, it's cool we got football, but I don't feel good about this.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, it's sort of like, geez, I remember what this felt. It was only 13 years ago. I remember what that felt like.
Yeah.
You know? I was happy and then a little, well, you know, what are we looked at? And, of course, there was this huge social media outcry about the Browns leaving, you know, the best fans in football, quote, unquote, and all this kind of dog pound. Blah, blah, blah. And then so I have to give tremendous kudos to the people in the Ravens organization that came here and knew that they had to work to get people excited about their team because we all felt uneasy about how we got it.
Right. And after the Colts and before the Ravens, the Baltimore had a CFL team. So they had tried football for a little bit in Baltimore. But
and
as,
showed
as
it
you
was
said,
viable.
And, but as you said, people were thinking, it's just not the same.
It's just not the same. CFL Colts drew pretty well. They did two major college games in here, like University of Maryland played University of Miami here, and Maryland played another game. I can't remember who they were against. But it was like they could fill up that stadium for football. It was easy to do.
Yeah.
Because people loved football in this town. The Colts always outdrew the Orioles.
Right.
You know, and you saw, you know, the Ravens outdrawing the Orioles again, you know, when things were. But, Kevin Byrne and those people, they understood the psyche of the town and stuff, and they did a lot in those early days to try to bring back that sense of family and fabric of the community and stuff like that. So I got to give them a lot of kudos because that was not an easy thing to do. It was a hard task in front of them.
Yeah.
But it worked out really well.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think people, once the NFL said, okay, Cleveland, you can have a team, people like me went, okay, that's fine.
Right.
They got their team, you know.
Let me go back to you working in the media when all this went down. How long was it the top story? Was it they left and that was it? Or was it?
Boy, you're asking me to remember 35 years ago.
I know.
I'm having a hard time remembering what I had for breakfast this morning. It was a big story for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know, and then it just kind of – and then it popped back up again when football season started in September.
Yeah.
Because the NFL decided that the football games that we were going to watch – I think it was Channel 2 was carrying the games from the AFC at that point. We were going to get the Colts games. And it was interesting because people were like, I'm not watching that.
Right, yeah.
I watched the first game or two, and it was just so odious to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like, I can't get into this. So I didn't watch. And for 13 years, I didn't have a football team, and I didn't watch NFL football in the spring. Now, in the fall. So if you think about how big of a sports fan I was thrilled to be working for a station that broadcast the Orioles or working for a station that broadcast – you know, stuff that had to do with the Colts when they were there. Now I was like, well, you know what I can do? I can go out and mow the lawn and rake leaves and do stuff. We'll find things to do. And
it's so much better than watching football.
Well, it's so much better than watching the Colts in Indianapolis. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, your heart doesn't break after you get done mowing the lawn.
And then the second thing the NFL did that I thought was particularly odious was they decided that because we were in the footprint of the Washington Redskins, they were going to shove the Washington Redskins down our throats, and that's the games we were going to watch on TV.
Hmm.
Now, if you're a longtime Baltimorean like I am, or Baltimorean, as people would probably like to refer me as, when I was growing up, the teams you most hated were in Washington. Mm-hmm. We hated the Senators and we hated the Redskins. And it was good because the Colts would always beat the Redskins and the Orioles would just pummel the Senators.
Right.
So we all felt superior in that term. So now here they're trying to feed me the Redskins, a team I grew up hating. forget about that. I'm not watching that.
Yeah.
So I think NFL ratings actually kind of went down here.
Huh.
And people, eventually I picked a team with colors I liked, okay?
Yeah.
So I liked the Seattle Seahawks. I would watch the Seahawks because I thought they had cool uniforms, which is a really bad way to pick your football team.
Yeah.
But that's what I did until we got our own team back.
Huh.
But then it was so many years since I'd sat in Memorial Stadium when we got a CFL team, and I had a son at that point. He was like 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah.
I took him to a game, and I walked in, and I thought, what a crappy stadium. Because I had all these wonderful fond memories from when I was a kid.
Right.
There thinking, this is the greatest stadium in the world. And you walk into it, and goes, no, it wasn't. We should have built them a new stadium.
Yeah.
They would have stayed.
So I see if you remember this. So after you get the call from your Mark Miller from the bedroom, you're covering it.
Right.
How does your show end that day?
Well, at one point in time, I got the idea to run to the record library. We had a fairly records, those flat things that we used to play on the radio.
Apparently, they're really popular again.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay. We had a lot of 45s and stuff and 33s. So I ran back and I found a copy of the Colts fight song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on a record that had been produced by National Beer.
All right.
In the late 50s, because the Colts won the NFL championship in 58 and 59, they had recorded the Baltimore Colts marching band doing it.
Yeah.
So I played the fight song. You know, it's probably the last thing I played going out of the end of our show. Just as like the final thing.
Yeah.
But I still tell you, it felt so surreal that morning.
I'm sure.
Just like it wasn't real.
Yeah.
It wasn't real.
And, I mean, you were kind of the one delivering the information.
Right.
Your team was delivering it to the public. But, again, right. you were a part of the band. You were still a fan of
still
the
fan.
Team.
Right.
So how was it for the on-air talent and you working the board? I mean, how was it to be hearing this?
Well, it's a weird thing when you're doing live broadcasting. There's a lot of adrenaline flowing around.
Sure.
You've got to kind of have that to do live on-the-air stuff. Because, you know, you don't want to let the ball down. So what ends up happening is it feels weird, but you're just going and doing and you're not really processing it because there's a lot of stuff to do. I got to keep the show on track. I got to play all the commercials at the right times and take network. And
Did you have commercials that were like, you know, proud sponsor of the Baltimore Colts while this was going on?
We may have. I don't really remember that, but that would be fitting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But we were just doing our jobs, and it really wasn't until the show ended and you walk out of the control room and then it starts to sink in, and then I got really depressed.
Yeah.
That's when it hit. You know, the adrenaline goes off, you're not on the air anymore, and that's when it really got. Because as breaking news is happening, stuff, you know, we're getting reports from here and there and everywhere, and we're setting up phone calls and talking to people, and we still have to do all our normal stuff that we have to do and play the little Don Spatz piece at 7:35 that we would play or do the news on time. And so you really get swept up in working, and you don't really get to reflect on it while you're doing it. You reflect on it later.
Right.
And it was then that I just went, wow, this is, you know, this happened and it's not coming back. Those guys are gone. And then there was this little glimmer of hope, because you hear about these things where they're trying to get this eminent domain thing through, which they never got.
Mm.
And it's sort of like you realize that once all that stuff was packed in those trucks and those trucks across the state line, they are not coming back.
That was it.
You can't get them back. The Supreme Court couldn't get them back.
Wow.
It was just gone. And it was like, and then you start thinking, we lost the team to Indianapolis?
Right. And you're still feeling the effects of that today, because when Indianapolis comes to Baltimore, they will not put the Colts name on any scoreboard. It says Indy.
Colts. It says Indy.
It says Indy.
Say
yeah. So, I mean, that's...
We used to call them the Ursays on BAL radio after that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Jim West would not say the word Colts.
Huh.
He would say, the Bills played the Ursays today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Absolutely. He held that. He still holds that grudge. He's almost 90.
Wow. I mean, that really shows you how rooted the team was in, into the city and everything else. And, I mean, my generation really hasn't experienced losing a team like that. They don't know what happened.
I hope you never do.
Right. But it fascinates me because, like you said, those people went into work one day and their jobs just weren't there. It was losing. You know, I don't think I have an article of clothing that doesn't have some sort of sports logo on it. For all of that just to go away one day, right. You know?
Just imagine showing up for work one day here at MPT and the door's padlocked and you can't get in.
Right.
And they just look at you and say, I'm sorry, we've gone out of business and you no longer have a job.
Yeah.
And you're just totally blindsided. That's what happened to all those people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure the general manager knew what was going on and I'm sure the coach knew what was going on, but the poor guy that, you know, ran the training room didn't know, and the secretaries that put together the travel schedules and, you know, all the others, ancillary folks like that were totally blindsided.
What about your show? Since now I'm sure a portion of your show was about sports and about the Colts, what were you covering after they left? Was it just Orioles? Was it high school, college games?
Yeah, we did. Well, what we would do is we did the Orioles. We did we would mention the Bullets and the Caps some. We would they were never huge. You know, it's kind of interesting how sports gets into it. But we did, you know, we would talk to the coach of Poly and City before their game, you know, Loyola and Calvert Hall before their game.
Mm-hmm.
We actually started broadcasting the Poly City game, and we would broadcast the Loyola Calvert Hall game on BAL radio after that, because we didn't have anything else to do. And then for a short while, we did University of Maryland football and basketball.
Okay.
So for football, what was interesting, Johnny Holiday did the games, but we would send our own crew, Jim West and Vince Bagley, and they would get whatever leftover press box there was and whatever whatever college stadium they were in. Sometimes they were sitting in the stands.
Yeah.
And doing the games. You know, because Johnny Holiday and the real broadcast crew had the main radio press box for visiting team. And for radio, for basketball, we would just take their feed and do Maryland. But it was, you know, we made an effort to keep doing sports, but, you know, there just was no NFL football there.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't touch the Redskins with a 10-foot pole.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for sitting down and telling me all about it. This has been a lot of fun. I'm hoping a lot of people listen to this that are Ravens fans and kind of know how important the Colts were and what it was like to lose a team like that. But, yeah, thank you so much for sitting down. And
you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
That's just a
reliving that.
Yeah. go watch. Maybe you can play the Baltimore Colts fight song. It's got to be on YouTube or something. When
done. Now the Baltimore Colts fight song, at least the tune is the Ravens fight song.
Yeah.
The Ravens tried.
So the Colts are still kind of alive here.
They are still kind of alive.
They just won't go away.
Fight, fight, fight.
All right. Thanks again. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Big thank you to Jim Bigwood for coming on the podcast, telling us all about that dreadful day. It was very funny. After we got done that conversation, Jim's like, man, that was really depressing. It took me back to the day when all that went down. Not my intention. I don't know. I guess it's because I grew up in Baltimore. I didn't have a team when I was born or the first, you know, 10 or so years, 10, 13 years of my life. I didn't have a football team. And then I became such a big football fan and Ravens fan. I've always kind of been intrigued because as a Ravens fan in Baltimore, when they're doing well, when the season starts, the town kind of gets decked out in purple. And to think that they were once decked out in blue and white and how that all went away at one point. It's always kind of fascinated me. We talked about the band that wouldn't die, the ESPN documentary, which I don't know if it's on ESPN Plus now or whatever, but we talked about that. Very good documentary, but it shows how much the team meant to this town. You see people crying. You see, people just heartbroken all over again. But this was a good conversation. You know, as Ravens fans, we kind of get spoiled how much the Ravens went to the playoffs and so many Hall of Famers that have been on this team. And really, this is one of the first times that the Ravens have really felt a giant shift, in the history of the team and where it goes next. So it's kind of interesting to remember what was in Baltimore at one point and what went away and why it went away and what it meant. You know, like Jim said, he didn't watch football for years after that all went down. But he's a Ravens fan, diehard Ravens fan now. We're happy to have him on board. Thanks again, Jim. So if you want to continue the conversation with myself or Josh, who will be back next episode, make sure you follow us on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at BrandoCash. Follow Josh at ItalianGQ52. It feels weird to not have him here talking to me about all the things going on with the Ravens, but this was just kind of like an opportunity that kind of showed up at my doorstep, so I had to take a shot. But Josh will be back next week. Tweet to him about all your Ravens questions. Go over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thecallpodcast. Like us over there. Whenever a new show comes out, since it is the off season, you never know when they're going to just pop up. Make sure you're following us over there. Like us, follow, do all that good stuff. Got the draft coming up. We'll be back covering that. We do the show for free. You listen, stream, and download for free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Baltimore Sports Report Network, Player.fm, Overcast, Google Play Music, and Satchel. All we ask in return is for you to please spread the word about the show. Let people know on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and Pinterest and Instagram and Reddit and Snapchat and Vero and Twitch, anywhere you are social on the web with your phone, say, I'm a Baltimore Ravens fan. I listen to The Call, and you should too. If you are local here to Baltimore, you have relatives that lost the Colts, talk to them. Talk to them about that. 35 years ago, the team left. And just talk about what it was like to go to those early games. Talk about what it was like when the team left. But also talk about the heyday and what Johnny U and the team meant to the city. So that's always important to remember where you came from and to be happy with what you have. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you all for listening. I don't know. Josh usually takes this out, so I guess I have to do it now. This feels weird, but Baltimore Ravens, Baltimore Colts, let's fly high. This has been a production of Brando Cash Entertainment. Music by Brad Lepore and Daniel Kelly from the DBK Studio. For more information, go to BrandoCash.com.
The Call is a member of the Baltimore Sports Report Network. Find more podcasts like this at BaltimoreSportsReport.com.